Into it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jennifer. Now, you're in for a real treat here because Jennifer is, we only get people, I say this aware of a fair bit, right? But we only get people on this show who have got huge hearts. And Jennifer is a case in point. And yeah, huge hearts. And that's why I love speaking to these people, because their hearts, you know, all the love coming out of them rubs off on me. And hopefully it rubs off on you, dear listener. So, Jennifer, great to see you. Great to have you on. Really looking forward to chatting with you.
Great to be here.
Yeah. So can you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
So great to be here this morning. My name is Jennifer Fell. I live in the United States, right? So on the East Coast, which is very distinct from the West Coast over here. So typically, it's funny that you talked about Simon, just people with big hearts. It's sometimes people say it's harder to find them on the East Coast.
All right, okay.
We bury them under a lot of work and professionalism, but they're certainly here. So. I am a foster parent for the state of Connecticut. I've been a foster parent for about 2.5 years. I currently have 2 children. And then what I do, I have professionally worked in healthcare for a long time. And as we'll talk a little bit later, I made the shift this year to just working with advocacy for foster care. So trying to change systems to make sure that the impact of the policies and procedures are meeting the families and the children's needs, educating the community on what foster care looks like, and then also recruiting really qualified foster parents.
Right.
Okay. Me in a nutshell.
Fantastic. So when you hear the phrase thriving adoptees, or I guess thriving foster children, you know, when you hear the term, maybe we go bigger, right? thriving kids, what comes to your mind when you hear that phrase, thriving kids?
So that's actually a term we use a lot when we talk about children, you know, placed in a home. And when we hear thriving, we think from just the basic physical needs. Are they growing? Do they look healthy? Are they eating well? All those kinds of things. And then we also couple that with education. Are they able to learn? Are they in a place where they're stabilized, so they're able to learn and grow. And then we also talk about emotionally. Are they able to be working on their emotions? So sometimes people will ask me, you know, have your children process their trauma or things like that? Like, no, no, they're going to continue to process it. But we're talking about thriving. We're talking about kids that are getting the tools to continue to move forward. And that's what I think of when you mentioned. It's about being ready to continue to progress.
Yeah. Progress, moving forward. Yeah. Onwards and upwards. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about your story to becoming a foster?
Sure. Sure. So keep me on track because I can talk about this for hours. Okay. So, but, you know, in the United States, we know we've had some controversial politics for a few years here, maybe for forever, but specifically in the past few years. And after the presidential election almost 5 years ago, there was just a real change in our culture. People just being very frustrated and angry, not necessarily doing anything about it. They were just kind of crying out. And so that really struck me. And I kind of said to myself, I need to find a way to give back, right? I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be somebody that's caught up in emotions or feelings, but not doing anything about it. So I made that commitment that I'd look to my social circle. At that point, or my sphere of influence, if you will. So at that point, I was working, you know, with some fair success in my career, and I was very busy, and I was all about my career life. I never wanted children, that kind of thing. And I saw this advertisement on, it was during an American football game, and they were talking about how kids in care do not typically graduate from college. Like if they've gotten out of, aged out of foster care, and they do not have a If they age out of foster care and they don't have an adoptive family, they typically will not finish college. They will fail out. And so this advertisement was to be a mentor for kids going through college. You had to sign up for 4 years and do all these things. And I thought, wow, that's something I could do, right? I could help somebody trying to get into the professional world, somebody who navigate college, like that would be awesome. And I called them the next day and, or I looked online the next day and they had gotten such a great response that they didn't need anyone for 2 years. Right. So for 2 years, I'm like, so I was like, oh, wow. And that hit me harder than I expected. Right. Like I was just really let down. I thought that's kind of weird. I don't, you know, it was just something I thought about. So that just kind of brewed with me and I continued to learn and look around and I just became so overwhelmed with the fact that I had such a good upbringing and I was safe and I had all my needs met. And here in Connecticut, one of the wealthiest states in, you know, in the country, we have 4,000 kids in foster care at any given time, right? Roughly. And so I just decided I'll be a foster parent, right? Which is not an easy process, but, and, you know, and so I got into that and I did the licensing. It took me about a year to become a foster parent. And I got my first placement about 2.5 years ago, my daughter who's still with me. And it was great. But what it sort of did is I got this transformation where she was just the most important thing in my life. Right. And her needs were so different from what mine had been and what I could see. And just continued to learn. And then when we had the pandemic, I actually got laid off from my job. And so I got furloughed actually. And with my spare time, I started reaching out to some of our legislators and talking to them about, hey, we have a great system, foster care system, but all our policies are not impacting the children in a positive way, or it might not even be reaching the children or the children's biological family, because in foster care, the first goal is always reunification with the biological family. So from that, it just grew. We got a seat at the table with the state to talk to them about things we wanted to see changed. And then we got in. And right around then we decided, I said, you know, I'm not going back to healthcare. I'm not going back to my old job. It's just not going to happen. I want us to formalize. And so we started a nonprofit called Fostering the Community. And then we just kept at it. So we've gotten invited to be part of the state, their internal meetings. We're helping them make decisions and shape foster care. And it's growing. And we're meeting all these wonderful people like yourself and really just continuing to drive change, because sort of going back to what you said, we want to see everyone thriving, right? We don't want to do all this work for it to fall flat.
Yeah.
So
fantastic. Fantastic. So series of insights and changes and dissatisfaction. And the interesting one was when you, the most interesting one was, the careers one. Oh, we don't need anybody for a couple of years. It's like, why would you put a limit on that? You know, you've got some volunteers. Somebody's come forward to volunteer. And it's just like, oh, okay. Well, no, we won't actually. Do you know, why would you get something like that? You know, somebody's reached their quota, so that's okay. You know, it's absolutely wonderful, isn't it?
That's a really interesting insight. Yeah, I had never thought about it from that way, that perspective. But yeah, there were probably two people sitting in an office, right? They were like, we're going to put out this ad and see if we get a response. And then
it's a bit like my the tradesmen around here, you know, they'll complain about being too busy. Well, okay, so you're too busy, right? So I'll tell you what. Hire some more people or put your prices up.
Right.
I can't do that. I went, oh, okay, then. why would you
want... We're not going to scale up. We're going to do just what we do.
No, we're not going to do that. No, we're not going to do that. Okay. So thriving then. So what have you learned around from your home raising foster kids? First question that comes to me, actually, and I should know this because we talked a couple of weeks ago. But it's gone from the head because we talked about so many different things. Are you wanting to adopt these kids going forward? Is that the plan, or did tell me, but I've forgotten. Sorry.
So foster care is obviously complicated. The first goal is always reunification with the parents, if that's going to help kids be safe and thrive. So my plan, I was actually in a pre-adoptive home. So my daughter was placed with me there was a lot of legal risk, but she was a pre-adoptive placement. My son was placed with me as an emergency. It was like a text message. I was sleeping. I said, sure, bring him here. And he was placed with me last July, and we're into the process of adopting. My daughter, I'm open to adopting, of course, but still finalizing if that's the right way to go. And so that gets, that's part of the emotional roller coaster in the process, because thriving, when you plan for a child to be with you indefinitely, looks a little different than thriving for a child that you want to help build tools for when they're not going to be with you. Does that make sense?
Do you mind if I ask you a little bit more about that?
Not at all.
I don't know what I'm going to ask you. You talked about the emotional roller coaster. I mean, that's like, wow. You know, if I think back, so my mum and dad, right, before they adopted me and my little sister, and, you know, my little sister isn't biologically related to me, you know, just she's 2 years younger than me. But before they did that, they did a lot of fostering. My mum and dad did a lot of fostering. I don't know how many kids they fostered, but they did. And I'm pretty sure that they knew that they were all short term. I'll have to ask my mum actually about that. I don't think there was that. This was the 60s, so I don't think it was really, the kind of foster to adopt stuff probably wasn't around there, but I'm not sure. How is the roller coaster with this uncertainty?
So it's tough. I think the big thing is that I'm surrounded with a lot of people that really care. They care about my kids. They care about me. And that helps, right? That helps diffuse the intensity of what it looks like. So, especially, when you get a child placed with you and you think they're going to be there with you indefinitely, and then maybe a few weeks into the placement, potentially there could be reunification. Oh, no, it's not going to happen. Oh, now there's another parent. Oh, no, it's not going to. And for that to go back and forth, I think the goal is to not get numb, right? Because you don't want to be numb to it, right? But you need to sort of accept it and be open to it in a way that we know nothing in life is certain. Right? Nothing in life is certain. And so the more you kind of embrace that and you go, yes, I would be sad if that didn't happen. Like, I talk to my daughter and I say, if you adopt me, what's going to happen? I said, we're going to throw a big party. And she said, well, if I reunify, what are you going to happen? I said, we're going to throw a big party, because no matter what, we are celebrating your future. Right? And that's the mindset you have to kind of work into, because it's hard. It's hard. And it's hard on both sides. It breaks my heart to think for the biological parents if they can't figure out how to reunify. And so when you deal with bureaucracy, like if you deal with social workers and in case managers, sometimes it's inconvenient for you to have these feelings. They don't love it. You're seeing it so much. They'll be like, Jennifer, don't worry about that. And I'm like, I'm just so sad for them, because it's
I thought these people are supposed to you know, when you say the word inconvenient, you know, like, okay, so my love for this little girl and this little boy is inconvenient. I'm sorry that I'm an inconvenience to you. I mean, it's just laughable, isn't it?
Right.
I'm gonna take a punt at this. Is that what you're learning? Actually, this isn't actually about mindset, right? This is just my theory. Okay, so you come back to me because this is supposed to be your platform, isn't it? And here I am pontificating my theory.
No, I'm thrilled to hear what it sounds like I'm saying.
I think what's happening is that you're actually learning through this, and you're learning how resilient you are.
Absolutely.
And this is one of the big, you know, in my Thrive model that I've come up with, the H is for resilience, right? And the biggest myth I think about resilience, it's sold to us by people selling resilience training courses. Are you feeling weak and vulnerable? Do you need more resilience in your life? Sign up here for only £999. Or today, you know, resilience is something, you know, it's that we use this word strengthen. We strengthen our resilience, and like we strengthen muscles, right? And so you're weak. Not you, Jennifer, but you, the prospective purchaser of my resilience training course, are weak, and I am strong. I have learned the strength to be, I've learned how to become strong. And if you pay me £999 or $999, available today at £499, then I will teach you how to be strong. And it's not like that. It doesn't work. Physical resilience, like strength, is you have to go to the gym to pump, you know, to pump iron and get big muscles. Resilience, emotional resilience, is unveiled. It's unveiled. And you are seeing by going through this, by riding the emotional roller coaster, you're realizing that you can ride.
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate. And we talked about this last time we spoke, is that I often say, like, you can't fake experience, right? So as you live it, you're getting better and you're growing, but you can't fake that. I wouldn't have been able to have this conversation with you 2.5 years ago. I would be pontificating about what a good foster parent looks like, but not having been able to feel, you know, what that feels like each day. What was I gonna
say? Yeah.
So
the reason that I went into that, stuff about resilience there is because it's for the listeners as well, yeah, because there's lots of people out there trying to sell us stuff and on the wrong basis. And if we want, you know, if we want our kids to be resilient, which mm-hmm. we do, because as one of my mentors says, life is a contact sport, right? So life is a contact sport. So we need to be resilient, but we will see our resilience rather than build it. Mm-hmm. And by laboring this point about seeing resilience, I'm hoping that the listeners see it. Although they're actually listening to me, so they're going to hear it, I guess, rather than see it. So, yeah. So what are some of the things that you've learned then on the thriving? So when you talked about thriving, you broke it down into like the physical, you broke it down into the physical stuff. Looking outwardly shining on the outside, you know, look, the kids are looking well, they're sparkling, they've got a sparkle in their eyes. So I think you broke it down to physical, you get like the educational side, thriving at school. And
which doesn't mean getting good grades, by the way. Thriving at school does not mean good grades in my assessment, you know. We'll talk about that more, but I always want to jump in there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad that you said that, because I have variable grades. So, and then the third bit you talked about was the kind of the emotional stuff, the emotional thriving emotionally. And you also said something about the trauma, which is very interesting. we might get onto that as well. So, so do you want to take a pick one of those, and which do you think is the most important, and share kind of what you've learned? You know, as you say, we can't fake experience. This show is all about sharing lived experience, not theory. I'm not really a fan of theory. I'm a fan of practice. So the point of the show is to help people share the lived experiences to help other people up their own learning curves.
Sure. Honestly, I'd like to start with physical, because I think you can't start with anything else if the kids don't feel physically safe, if they're not physically being nurtured. Like, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all of that kind of thing. So, and I'm a dietitian by trade. So I'm, you know, nutrition and well-being is important to me. But so typically for me, what I've learned, when the kids come into your home, I think just sheerly whatever has brought them into care, right? And whether it's been neglect or it's been abuse or it's been misunderstanding of who could care for that child, things like that. They don't look well. The stress of what they've been through, they don't look well. And if you would put them in a group with a bunch of other kids, you'd say like you said, that sparkle is missing. Right. And so the first thing, and that I've always been committed to myself, even prior to having kids, is I said, I hope that the kids recognize me as someone safe. Right. So we do everything we can when they first come into your home to create a safe environment. Get down low. You don't get in kids' faces. You don't do that kind of thing. You let them understand that they're autonomous, that they are safe. And this goes for any age child. Right. And then what I've learned is as you get to know them, we don't make food a big deal. Food's never been a big deal because whatever a child's experience is with food prior has shaped the way they feel in terms of, am I going to get enough food or is just candy food? You know, I have a friend that said their kids had only eaten like Skittles and soda. They didn't know what milk was, right? So it can be that extreme to just... there wasn't enough food regularly. So create that environment. You'll have enough food. You'll have a safe place to sleep. How do you like to sleep? Those kinds of things. And we start to just kind of wrap them in that. Like, this is bath time. This is when we normally take a bath. How do you like to? And as you start to work with them and find out what their experience is and help show them what you need to do to take care of your body, it's amazing. Because they start to grow. You will buy them all new clothes because they'll need clothes, and they will be out of those clothes in a month. And as you go to the doctor's visits, they're just growing so much and they start to thrive, and you can see that sparkle comes back. And you cannot expect anything for a child if they don't feel safe, if they're not nourished, and if they're not getting enough sleep. It's just like, it's the end of the road for you if you haven't met those basic needs. And I just think that that's something that sometimes we get caught up in all the other things. And I think that is all we need to do in the beginning. And also with safety comes demonstrating love. And for kids, that might be by doing things. They might not be ready for hugs and cuddles and kisses, but they might need that too, right? But creating that environment for them is just fundamental to starting off on the right foot and getting that child ready for their floor. Some of the other things that come along with foster care.
Yeah.
Right. Because foster care is not a benign placement for kids. There's a lot of work in terms of the social workers are involved in their lives. They're having visits maybe with family members. They're trying to process what's been going on. So it's not a benign condition, if you will. It's very active for them.
Yeah. What do you mean by benign?
I think, you know, ideally, right, when we think about, a kid being removed from whatever situation and put in foster care, you think, okay, well, they're removed from that trauma. They're somewhere safe now and things will be fine for them. But actually that removal is tremendously impactful. There's a lot of trauma there. Sometimes when they're reunifying, they're getting reintroduced to parents they never met before. Now you're finding out you have this parent. You are, you're trying to build a relationship with them. It's very confusing. They have all kinds of physical assessments and people talking to them and coming into your home to see how you're doing and wanting to talk to you privately to make sure you're safe. That's a lot for a kid. Or before, they just got to be at home, right? You know, if I look at, you know, my nephews or my brother and sister's sister-in-law's biological children, if people were coming into their lives like that, I think it was insane. And we expect kids to take that as normal.
Yeah, I did some one-to-one work with kids with their, you know, the mom or dad with me in the first instance, or maybe just in the next room. And the kids were, and this is the first time that had happened to those kids, and the kids are like, what's going on? You could tell, you know.
Yeah.
They're like, and their thoughts went to kind of, what's wrong with me? Why, you know, why is mum? I'm talking about, this is one-to-one work. So I'm talking about fairly affluent parents, you know? I don't know why that's got anything to do with it, but these kids hadn't been through any trouble. They were just, any trouble like what you're talking about. They just had some issues at school, or some, they'd been, one of them had been bullied, or one of them settled into a school well, and some, you know, transitions around divorces. Mm-hmm. That hadn't gone too well, and you know, but even so, when I came into to work individually with the kids before I focused in the adoption stuff, the kids were like really not freaked out, but they knew something was wrong, that mum or dad had to bring this strange guy, as in me, into the house, you know. So mm-hmm. they pick up on this stuff, and so. I guess you probably don't get used to that. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think they, this is pretty heavy, but like they remember being removed even if they were little. And so whenever somebody comes into their house, they sense that it's official and they're like, what am I leaving? Am I staying? Like they don't, you know, and then we accept that as part of normal life. Like, oh, if you got a, you know, you got a bruise, let me take a picture. I have to send it to your social worker. Like, that's so weird, right? It's so weird, especially when they've been in care for a long time. You know, like, that's their normal now.
Yeah, yeah. So what else would you like to share on the thriving piece?
Geez, what else? I think the emotional part is really my favorite part to work with. I always joke, like, I was not a parent before I became a foster parent. I didn't want to be a parent before I became a foster parent. So I always joke, I would say, I'm not like the best mom, but I'm real good at trauma, right? I'm really good at relationships and the emotional piece. And so I think one of the biggest things to help kids thrive as a parent, right? So as a parent, is becoming aware of what your triggers are. Right. And becoming aware of things that upset you when you hear it and set that aside, like throw that out the window, because you're not that child. Right. So you need to start to, as you're helping kids thrive, you want to be able to align with them emotionally and say, I'm going to sit next to you. You tell me what this feels like. You tell me why this is scary. You tell me why this is, makes you angry. And I'm going to help you get those tools to navigate this together. You're not a bad kid because you work that way. That was what was in your toolkit. You know, maybe anger was in your toolkit. Maybe shutting down was in your toolkit. That's okay. That's what you used before. But now we need to start looking at some other things. And so you really have to be me and you against the world, helping that child move forward. And you can't necessarily rely on what your experiences have been before personally. It's really about helping to uncover what the child has been through. And that is the work I love to do with my kids. Like, it's the hard stuff, but it's the important stuff for kids in care.
So what have your biggest learnings been in around that area?
Let's see. what have my biggest learnings around that? You know, with my daughter, we do a whole lot of work. Probably the biggest learnings would be around understanding how she sees other people in her life, right? So understanding how she sees her mom, how she sees her dad, how she saw relatives, friends that said they were aunts and uncles, and what that triggered in her. Was it happiness? Was it safety? Was it fear that they were going to disappear? Was it parentification where she felt like she had to take charge? So for instance, she used to argue with me from four about, I don't know, how I was cooking dinner. And I'd be like, get out of here, kid. You know, at some point I was like, I think I had shared, like, I used to oversee, you know, I had like 200 employees in this big region I used to oversee. Like, she didn't care, you know, she didn't care who I was or who I thought I was. She just wanted to make sure I knew how to make pancakes correctly. And she didn't even know. And so that parentification I would bump up against until I started to learn, well, that comes from somewhere, right? That's come from feeling like somebody's got to be in charge. It might need to be me, 3-4 years old. Those kinds of things. And that's, you know, that's not uncommon, right? But again, that's where I throw out my trigger of like, don't tell me how to do things in my house, right? I throw that out, you know, let's go, you know, like, what's going on? Like, I still am going to make pancakes my way, you know, little lady, but what are you afraid of? What are you worried about? What can I give you control of something else so that you feel part of it, you know?
Yeah. So you're using these as kind of little mini learning opportunities then?
Yeah, absolutely.
So for you to learn.
For me to learn. And I would say fundamentally, like, yes, learning, absolutely. But even on a deeper level, it's really just, it's taught me how to love, to be honest with you. Like, I thought I knew what love looked like, but it's learning and getting that commitment to just love them in a way that's going to let me say, okay, I don't have it right this time. I'm going to learn more. We're going to figure out some more. We're going to work through it together. So yes, it's ongoing learning, but also that's partnered with a commitment of love too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Who did I say? I said this to somebody this morning that I hear people say, you know, people, you know, foster parents and adoptive parents, they think that love's enough. And I said, well, and I think to myself, well, it's probably the best place to start. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It isn't enough, but it is the foundations. And you know, and the bigger the heart, the bigger the love. I don't know. Is that even the thing? No. Like, love is infinite, isn't it? They say, people say love is infinite. So, you know, but infinite love, coming from infinite love, that's the foundation. And, you know, love, it's love and understanding, isn't it? It's not understanding and love. That's the way we say it. Yeah. Also, I wanted to sing the really cheesy Foreigner song from the 1980s, I Want to Know What Love Is.
It's so true though. Like, it's funny, I always tell people, I'm like, you know, my daughter has taught me, you know, taught my cold heart how to love. Like, I always considered myself to be a loving person, but when you're like, you know, looking at this child, it's standing in your bedroom door at 3 a.m letting you know that they're very disappointed that you took them to ballet class late the other day. They do not like being let down, and you're like, okay. Like, you know, it's that, like, okay, let me dig deeper. There was a need here that we need to meet, versus, you know, yelling, go back to bed.
Yeah. Enough of this laughter and good times. I'm just thinking, what's the question I've not asked?
What's the question you've not asked?
What's the answer to the question I've not asked?
I don't know. You're going to have to help me out with this a little more.
What would you like to... Oh yeah, trauma stuff. You said that you're on that. You said something about, yes, are they over their trauma yet? You know,
have they processed their trauma? I'm like, they don't even know what their trauma is yet. Like, that's the thing. Like, you know, like think about all these things that happen as adults. When you're an adult and you look back at your childhood and you're like, oh, I got to work on that. Right?
Yeah. I want to bring something up about this, because I saw something on this. It was one of those checklists on, it was a checklist on Twitter, and I just knew this is going to be bad, right? So it was something to do with trauma, and it looked really scientific and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But it said that worrying is down to trauma. And it, along with another 10 things, right? And I just thought, well, everybody worries. So everybody must have gone through trauma. It's just like, it's... Have you heard this phrase, confirmation bias? Right? This phrase, confirmation bias? Basically, yes. What we focus on gets bigger, right? So,
yes,
you know, she, so like, is she through the trauma? She doesn't know what it is yet, but I sometimes think that, they're kind of like, and I'm just talking about myself here.
Yeah.
Just talking about myself, that I have focused on bad things, mm-hmm, and they have got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I brought a magnifying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
To bad stuff in my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it has got bigger, and that's what, mm-hmm, confirmation bias is. Sounds a bit more kind of scientific, doesn't it? Because that's what they do, scientists. Yeah, but you know, but is there a danger that?
Yeah,
is there a danger that we talk stuff into? Is there a danger that we talk stuff into being more solid than it is?
So. That's a great question. I think that, you know, we know the mind is very fluid. We know that, like, everything changes. Like, by the time we're done with this podcast, our minds are going to be rewired a little bit differently, surely, just from connecting and learning, right? This happens every day. And so you can do that for good or bad.
Yes.
And so I think there can be a danger to just focusing on the trauma, but what, as a foster parent, as a parent of a child that has gone through trauma, the biggest thing is that in your parenting lens, you have to realize that biologically, this trauma changes these children. It changes them. And so we know, are you familiar with the ACE scores, the birth childhood experiences, right? We know that if you have a score, I think of an 8 or above, your life expectancy is 20 years less than somebody with a score of 0 or 1. We know that it changes the stress hormones before they're able to handle it, right? It can put them through puberty earlier. There's so many things that happen with this trauma lens, or with trauma. And so this, here's a very specific example. Kids that have been through a lot of trauma, their cortisol does not go out down during the day. So we start with ours pretty high. We wake up, we go through the day, it starts to go down, and then we're able to wind down and go to sleep. Okay. Kids that have been through a lot of trauma, it starts out low, right? They can't get out of bed. They're exhausted. And then it goes up throughout the day. And when it's bedtime, they can't wind down. And it's crazy. And they have night terrors and all these things. Traumas can physically change the body, right? But if you don't know that, Like, my kid's a pain in the butt. She won't get out of bed in the morning and she won't go to bed at night. And this is her own fault. She's tired throughout the day. So the sort of trauma lens of going, okay, let's create a safe environment at night. Let's kind of work through it. Let's really prepare you. Let's talk to the doctor to see if melatonin or something like that helped you. That's the trauma lens that helps them get, you know, helps you work through. If a child had a bad experience at a loud party where maybe people were, drinking too much or something, and they neglected this child's needs. If you go to a party, it could be a kid's party, that could trigger a trauma response for your child, where they sort of, they rewire. I mean, their frontal lobe actually shrinks through excess. So I'm not talking about necessarily rehashing the events, but knowing that impact on the children and helping them heal from that. Right. And that is where the trauma work is so important. We help them say, okay, you're scared. Let's take a deep breath. Let's go somewhere safe. Let's think through this. What do we need to do? And help them to rebuild and rewire from it. So yes, we've all had trauma, but not always nearly as significant as happened. And so I think, so we do a lot of trauma work. I do fear, though, that it becomes so much of a buzzword that nobody's going to really take it for what it is, right? But there is so much work to be done when you use that lens and partner with your child moving through something.
Yeah. Because I saw something, adoption figures in the UK. It was figures research with adopted children in the UK. And it said that their mental health hadn't improved 4 years after. 4 years after they had been adopted.
Yeah.
So to me, that says that we're not doing enough on the neuroplasticity stuff. We're not doing enough to stimulate that stuff to improve.
Yeah. I mean, so we, one of the sort of mottos of my nonprofit is there's work to be done, right? And so that's what we always say. It's such a good place to kind of, as we talk about all these things and we see all these, gaps from what the children need. Like, if we're not seeing improvements in mental health, we know there is work to be done, right? And that's sort of where I take some of the burden, and I can see that you do too. We share this burden of there's work to be done. We need to educate. We need to put in programs and things like that.
So what's the most effective? I'm not going to say, how do we do that work? Because that would be just a reductionist, stupid question to ask. But I'm going to ask it hopefully a little bit more constructively. So what's the most effective work? For adoptive and foster parents listening, what, in your opinion, is the most effective work or works? I'm not saying one. I'm trying to ask a question that isn't reducing it down to the 10 steps to deal with your trauma.
Honestly, I think it's patience and consistency, right? So we know that neurons that fire together, wire together. So as your kid continues to go through life and you continue to say, you're safe, you're protected, and we have ways to figure this out. You don't have to lash out. You don't have to freak out. You're safe and you're protected and we can figure it out. And the next day you're safe and you're protected and we can figure it out. And the more you continue to do that and create that consistency, that is going to help. That helps them grow. That helps them learn trust. That helps them continue to build this. Again, going that helps them build that security that we talked about in the beginning. That is one of the most important things that parents can do. Be predictable.
Be predictable. And repeat, I guess. So what I think, when I had, you had a team of 200, I had a team of five. I think probably one of the mistakes I used to make was I used to think it once and done, said and done once, That was probably one of my many failings as a leader,
Me too. I'm all about achievement, not mastery.
Once and done, yeah. So persistence, continuity, and consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and repetition, is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in preparation too. So that's part of it. Like, this is what's going to happen. We're going to wake up. We're going to eat breakfast. We're going to dress. We're going to get in the car and letting them know. And so then when you tell them that, then do it, right? And do it every day. And the more you kind of build that process so they know what to expect, they know, you know, I try to give these examples too, without going off, you know, giving examples of how bad things could have been, because a big part of what we do is also creating relationships with biological parents, right? Whether that you're still fostering or you're going to adopt a child, the biological parents have a huge role in the process. And it's easy to be like, they're bad and we're good. And that is not the case, right? And every parent loves their child. And so kind of opening, you know, so I try to be careful with the examples because I don't want it to look like I'm disparaging the biological parents because they have their own challenges too.
Yeah.
But you know, if there wasn't that level of predictability, what that morning schedule is, who was going to be in the house in the morning, who was coming home, think about how important it is to know when I wake up, this is who will be here. This is what's going to happen. And this is how I'm going to start my day.
Yeah.
And like you said, that the repetition, the consistency, predictability, all of those things, really fuel the basis for kids to start to work through some of that trauma.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, I think we're bringing this in. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
I think my biggest thing, right? So like, you know, I kind of think like, well, who might be listening? So I would say this. I would say for people that are in the mix of it, the people that are in doing foster care, they are adoptive parents. It is easy to get down sometimes where you do not think you've seen progress or you think you're not doing the right thing. I would say for those parents, keep going, you know, and just get through that day, get through that hour if you need to, but the work you're doing is good and important, and seek support. You know, have support network that can help you through it, because it's what you're doing is so critical and valuable. I would say for the people who are thinking about adopting, right, and people who are thinking about becoming foster parents, sometimes it seems scary when we hear all these things that could be going on. But it's not nearly as scary as it sounds. I think life is full of risk, and there is nothing more rewarding than seeing your kids grow and thrive and start to become children that are not worried and children that can just engage as normal children, right? To just see them carefree, there's nothing better than that. So go for it. That's what I would say.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you. It's been very enlightening. I hope as for the listeners as well. See you all soon, guys. Bye-bye.